Is he my prince? Is he the toad? Waiting, wondering, is getting too old. I'm gonna let down my hair, slide up my skirt. Get me up, be the biggest little flirt. Welcome to the Shame Free Zone with Veronica Monet, your friendly former sex worker and certified sexologist. The Shame Free Zone is a safe place for your questions and your secrets about all things sexual.
This is the Shame Free Zone, and I'm your host, Veronica Monet. We've got another Monday evening going on here, and boy, oh boy, I'm looking at a lot of comments to the question that I posed on Facebook here. Really kind of stirred the pot. The question that I posed was, do you believe in unconditional love? Now, before I tell you what I think and what my friends on Facebook think, I want to tell you a little bit about my guest tonight. His name is Bob Quinlan, and he's the author of a brand new book. It's called Earn It, Empower Yourself for Love. And I think he's got some rather controversial ideas about unconditional love, so that's going to be very interesting. He's also got a really uncommon background in both psychiatric nursing and medical cells. And then, of course, like so many of us, he's had his own ups and downs in the world of romance. But, Bob, welcome to the Shame Free Zone.
Thank you very much.
So, what was it that prompted you to write this book? Is this your first book?
It is. Yes, and it started when I had ended my 20-year marriage to my high school sweetheart and learned some lessons on what not to do as we gradually unearned our love over the 20 years. And then shortly thereafter, I met another lady my same age that I fell in love with, and just started writing down some notes on how I could possibly stay that in love with her 20 years down the road. I wanted to make sure the same thing didn't happen again. And what it started off as a paper for my own personal knowledge, kind of like just doing a diary, evolved into almost a book. And then when my youngest daughter was getting married, I wanted to actually make it a book that, you know, most parents want their kids to have it better than we do, but we unfortunately only teach them by example most of the time. So I gave her the first copy of the manuscript at her wedding 10 years ago. They're happily married, and my girlfriend and I are now happily married and have been for 13 years.
Well, congratulations. Now, I understand your book endeavors to use terminology that both men and women can understand or identify with.
Definitely.
Can you explain that a little bit? What is the difference between terminology that men might be comfortable with, and that, you know, I mean, why do we need a book that strives to talk to both men and women?
Because men and women think and feel differently, obviously. You know, men are from Mars, women are from Venus was a great start. Men seem to be more logical and less emotional. So I like to say if men are taking too long to understand the more feminine emotional world of Venus, maybe by having women understand the more logical masculine world of Mars, we can maximize our relationships.
You're a big fan of John Gray's.
I am, most definitely. Yeah, men are good business people, and women are great business people. You know, the women aren't protected homebodies like they used to be. Today's economy just doesn't allow that most of the time. So it's estimated that 17% of all the businesses are now owned by women. And so there's a very, rather than emphasizing the differences between men and women, mm-hmm. one thing we both understand well are business terms and principles. Sometimes we treat our clients and our coworkers better than we treat our spouses.
That's
so by using those terms, men can understand romance. You know, it may not be as warm and fluffy, but we definitely understand things like investment and return on investment, updating our customer files frequently. We know our customers need to change. Well, guess what? So do our spouses need to change.
Now, you know, about 80% of all book sales actually accrue to female readers.
That's true.
Do you have any idea who your book is popular with? Are you mostly appealing to men or women?
To both. I actually started it with Rotary. I'm very involved in Rotary, and that's mostly men, though they're about 10% women. And they're very good business people, but when I did the first presentation of this book's principles 8 years ago at our Rotary Club for Valentine's Day, I had several wives come up to me in tears saying, please publish his book. My husband is a great guy, very giving, generous man in Rotary and other aspects. He's a wonderful businessman. He treats our children well, but he takes me for granted. And that's a common problem at home and at work, is that we get comfortable with our clients or with our spouse, and we get comfortable, sometimes too comfortable, and focus less on re-earning their business or re-earning their love.
Well, so let's talk about that a little bit. You actually say that you believe that love is conditional, both logically, physically, and emotionally. Do you want to expand on that a little bit?
Sure. If you can think of, if your listeners will just think of anything that they think constitutes love. You know, I know our society promotes unconditional love, and it's a wonderful goal. It's something we can all strive to achieve, but I have never witnessed it by anybody. Sometimes we do unconditional kindnesses, but the idea of loving somebody is very deep and involved. And if we don't get that reinforced somehow, and it doesn't need to be from the other person, self-satisfaction, just knowing that you're doing the right thing, can be very rewarding. Hopefully reciprocated, that when you love somebody, hopefully they do love you back. But if you don't get some kind of return on that investment, eventually people withdraw, they don't give as much, and so then the other partner stops giving as much as well, and that's how couples just drift apart.
Well, let me see if I understand. You had a little caveat there that was a bit intriguing. Is you're talking about a return that doesn't necessarily have to come from the person that you're loving. Are you suggesting that most acts of altruism actually are selfishly motivated in some way?
Yes, I do believe that. That sometimes we can get rewards from other people respecting us. Sometimes it's just knowing that you're doing the right thing can be very rewarding. Some people believe it creates good karma in this life or future lives. Some people believe that that's the way to get into heaven. So there are some rewards. You know, like, say an example, a spouse becomes deathly ill. They get cancer or they get in a car accident. They're in a coma. You know, they obviously can't earn much love like that. But that person, the other spouse, can know that they're doing the right thing by sticking with them, taking care of them. And that can be rewarding. You can get rewards from other people, your children or friends who admire you or respect you for doing that and thinking that maybe you're creating good karma or a place in heaven. That gratification can be postponed, but if it's completely void of any kind of rewards, eventually people will stop giving. And that's how couples drift apart and they just end up unhappy with each other over years of being taken for granted.
Suggesting that people can create self-motivating rewards for unconditional love. Now, whether we want to call it conditional or unconditional, the idea that you don't have to expect something in return from the person that you're loving seems like that would be a great goal to aspire to.
I agree.
So I'm going to read a couple of comments from, like I said, there was a bunch of them here tonight, but the question was, and I said, I believe in unconditional love, do you? And so here are responses from some of the Facebook fans. We've got Daniel says, is there any other kind? Tisha says, for sure. Mike says, not only believe in it, but experienced it. Amanda Wright says, yes, I absolutely 100% believe in unconditional love. As a mother, I can say I finally truly know what it is to love fully and completely, unconditionally. No matter what happens, the love remains the same. David says, without it, conditional, personal puppy, filio, love cannot be sustained. And Joe Bob says, love is an exploding cigar we willingly smoke. Okay, sounds a little bit cynical there. He says, yes, this is for me. He thinks that love can be unconditional. Tamara says, I do not question unconditional love. And Jerome says, I do. John says, I beg, and you might surrender. Not sure what that means, John. And then we've got Lisa here. Lisa says, honestly, I would love to believe it does, but I agree with another poster who had said only dogs have unconditional love. His name is Hokie. He says, only dogs have unconditional love. Lisa says, I agree with Hokie that dogs know how to love unconditionally, and that is what we can aspire to. What do you think about that? You think dogs know more about love than humans?
They seem much more loyal, don't they? Yeah, it's a good start. I think the two that are closest, I mean, outside of the human realm, I think dogs and God are the most loving creatures, and they seem to be able to give unconditionally. But with adults or with people, there are conditions associated with them that people can either earn love, they can unearn them. As I started to say before, if you start to think of any of the components of love, anything or a one-word synonym for love, whether it's respect or gratitude, passion, caring, friendship, if you think of all of the components of them, and seriously, please take a moment, just think what love means to you, and I'll bet you a nickel that is either earned or unearned. Doesn't unconditional respect sound absurd? You don't expect unconditional honesty. Unconditional friendship. Friendships come and go. People either earn those friendships or they unearn them. So I would pose that if all of those components of love can be earned or unearned, then I think there's some love can also be earned or unearned. And by accepting that, it's very empowering, because if you think that it's unconditional, that it's going to exist no matter what you do or don't do, then there's no motivation to try to earn it. You know, if you take love for granted, and that can happen in any circumstance. I think that a parent and child is the closest thing to unconditional love. I've got four children that I truly love very much, but that also could be unearned. You know, if a parent abuses the child, you know, say a father molests the child, I don't think that child needs to love that parent as much. If a child puts the parent in the old folks' home and forgets about them for years, there are many people that they may not have Alzheimer's, and they've kind of, they still love their child, but not nearly as much as they could. You know, if they brought their children by, if they came by and visited, if they called them occasionally, Mom, Dad, how are you doing? That parent can love that child more or less.
I guess as a psychiatric nurse, you've probably actually seen examples of this, huh?
Unfortunately, they exist, yep.
So it's an interesting concept, really. It kind of has to back us up a little bit about what is love, because some people feel that love is an emotion that they feel, mm-hmm. and other people might say love is an action. That's just saying that word or having a feeling is kind of a moot point, that what we want are actions that are loving. Where do you fall on that continuum?
Great point. I'm glad you mentioned that about the actions. I'm extremely romantic. My wife and I were dating. She lived in San Francisco. I lived in Sacramento. We lived 100 miles apart, and so we would drive to see each other two or three times a week. And guys would hit on her, and she said once at a bar, a guy asked her, "Have you ever been really romanced?" And she looked him dead in the eye and said, "My boyfriend's the king of romance." That was nicely defended. I was very appreciative that she appreciated what I had been doing for her. I constantly strive for that. It's just like in business. And that's what's unique about my perspective, is that I'm not a PhD that has just lived in a academic environment. You know, I've done a lot of reading, but I've learned this by personal experience when I watched, like I said, in counseling, seeing people get taken for granted, and that's where love was unearned. In business, I've seen a lot of sales reps go in and get a client to commit, they get them to sign a contract, and then they take them for granted. They quit coming by so much. They quit asking, what else can I do for you? What are your current needs? Has anything changed in the last year? But if you do that in your relationship at home as well, okay, honey, the kids are growing up now. What are we going to do when they go away to college? What are some shared goals that we have? What are some shared interests that you and I can focus on one another? That, because personally, I learned that the hard way. When my children grew up and it was just my ex-wife and I, we were kind of lost. It's like, okay, well, now what do? We were great parents together and we were both good people, but we just didn't have any shared interest. Unfortunately, my children had become the most important thing in my life, and same with her. Whereas in the second marriage, I've learned that my spouse is the most important thing. And I actually apologized to my ex-wife when I realized that. She should have been the most important thing in my life, and unfortunately, she wasn't.
So you talk about unearning love. Can you kind of define that for us? I think you've hinted at it, and some of us may have already figured it out, but I'm looking for something that's a little more concrete for our listeners.
It's basically taking your partner for granted. Whether it's your personal spouse or a client, a coworker, Anything that's taken for granted is vulnerable. If you don't take them for granted and you constantly strive to re-earn their business or re-earn their love, then you become more valuable to them, and they will want to keep you around if for no other reason than just to meet their future needs. But they're probably going to be gracious that you are gratified that you did meet their needs. So in appreciation, they're going to want to meet your needs. It becomes a very healthy giving cycle. And it, I do want to preface that it should not be on a tit-for-tat basis. You don't just give when you expect to receive. But the act of giving creates a healthy environment where that inspires the other one to want to give as well.
Yeah, it is actually, you know, I love the sounds of unconditional love.
Mm-hmm.
And I think as far as the definition goes for a lot of people, it does have some merit, because I think a lot of people are using the word unconditional love to try to train themselves away from the whole tit-for-tat type of mentality.
Yes, I agree with you that they think that that's... And also, especially with women, because good little girls, and I raised two of them, are taught from when they're toddlers, you're supposed to give and give and not expect anything in return. Well, that's not true. It's not true in business. Women, apparently, studies show that they have more trouble asking for rewards. It's like they're more hesitant to go in and ask the boss for a raise because they don't want to ruffle their feathers, and so they... But women need to give themselves permission to get a return on that investment. It's fair and reasonable at business. It's fair and reasonable at home as well.
Yeah. So how would that apply if a woman is feeling taken for granted? Maybe, you know, maybe she's a mother. Mm-hmm. She's cooking, cleaning, holding down at least a part-time job, if not a full-time one. Mm-hmm. You know, the average American woman who is in a two-income family, in other words, she is working just as hard on a job, just as many hours as her husband, is still going to, and in a household, you know, where ostensibly the agreement is they share housework,
mm-hmm.
at the end of the year, she will have still expended an extra 2 weeks' worth of work in the house.
Wow.
So there is a great deal of inequity between the genders even now in 2010. What would you recommend to our female listeners if they happen to be in that situation where they are becoming aware of the fact that although they're splitting the housework and splitting the job of supporting the family, they're still kind of getting stuck with the lion's share?
I've read very similar studies that women that work outside of the home are still doing 90% of the housework, and that's not even including child care. I would recommend the first step would be to point that out to their husband in a loving, non-threatening, non-aggressive manner. Say, honey, you know, we're a partnership. And it was my belief that we were going to share these things 50-50. You know, I respect the things that you contribute. I know you're bigger and stronger, and you're there for me. You will protect me. You open car doors for me, and I appreciate that. And give them some positives for whatever they do well, but then also remind them, but I don't feel like I'm contributing more than my share around the home. You may actually be making more money, which is generally the case. Women aren't paid for the same job at the same pay scale. But I have seen studies where women, the services that they provide for a full-time stay-home mom are worth between $84,000 and $148,000 per year. When you think of the nanny and the chefing and the chauffeuring, so even those that are staying home are earning their keep, and yet men sometimes don't give them credit for that. And if that first step would be to point that out to the man, you know, that this is not quite equitable. Thank you very much for giving us the vote 90 years ago, but things continue to progress, and I feel like I'm entitled to a return on this investment.
Yes, well, as a feminist, I think it's incumbent upon me to just say nobody gave us the vote. We fought really hard for that. But
you didn't get my tongue in cheek on that one, huh?
No, I got it.
Okay, good.
I just didn't want to underline it. So let's talk about how you use business terminology. And you have referred back to business terminology so far in the last 20 minutes, but maybe help our listeners understand how they could bring these business concepts into the problem solving in the context of their relationships?
Well, there are a lot of similarities between business relationships and romantic relationships. Successful business people, whether they're men or women, understand these concepts. Like I said, assets and liabilities. Some behaviors add to the value of the relationship while others detract from the value. Investments and return on investments, you know, basically a give and take. Men and women are both used to that. And like I said, updating your customer files frequently, because all business people know that their customer needs are going to change, but we don't think about that at home, you know, because we're kind of, most of us, men and women, are more selfish when we get home because that's our escape. That's where, okay, I went out, I conquered, I, you know, got beat up by the world, and now I'm going to come home, take off my shoes, and just relax. And so, and which is a good thing. We need that safe environment where we can recharge our batteries. But some people take that to an extreme, and they are not contributing their share. You know, if your man needs 15 minutes to relax when he gets home, which apparently men need more than women. Women are better multitaskers, so they're used to getting home. Okay, we got to start doing this, get ready for the kids. But men need to start contributing more, even if it's after that 15-minute break. You know, if we take a client or a lover for granted, we're eventually going to unearn their business or their love. And that's why the idea of not thinking of love as unconditional, it's really empowering to us, because we know that we can influence the conditions that do affect love. You know, whether it's you're finding out what's important, just like we would with a client, where you have to find out what their needs are. We don't just walk in and say, hey, this is what I've got, so this must be what you need. That doesn't work in business. That doesn't work at home either.
Well, and you talk about changing needs. Now, I think this is a very interesting concept, because I teach workshops to couples to help revitalize their relationships. And there's something that I teach called Date Your Mate. And the rules that I established for Date Your Mate program is that it has to be like a first date. So I encourage people to go someplace and, you know, maybe sit across from each other over dinner, where they can actually have conversation, because this is what people do on first dates. They want to talk so they can get to know each other. So as opposed to actually going and doing something where you're going to be watching a movie or listening to a concert, that's usually the kind of material that you do on maybe a subsequent date. But usually when people are just meeting for the first time, they do actually want to have some time to talk.
Excellent.
Established couples tend to avoid talking, you know. They feel like they've already talked about everything, and the less they talk, perhaps the more less likely they'll be to have a conflict. But and then I also tell them that they need to talk about things like politics, music, current affairs, and religion.
Controversial, huh? Yeah.
Yes. Well, not only that, but these are usually the kinds of things that you want to know about somebody that you're first going out with. Like, you know, what religion are you? How were you raised? How do you vote? Because you're kind of trying to figure out if this is somebody you want to spend time with, or maybe even the rest of your life with. But after people have been together for 10 to 20 years, it seems they assume that that person lying next to them in the bed is still of the same political party, still the same spiritual views, still likes the same kind of music, that absolutely nothing has changed about them. I think this is one of the reasons people go out and have affairs, because the person in their office or at their gym actually sees them.
And listens to them and talks to them. And talks to them and listens to them. You're right.
Yeah. So talking about that, talk a little bit, if you can, to this whole idea of keeping current with your customers' ongoing and changing need sets. I would like to hear about that.
Sure. It's basically boils down to being interested. You know, like you said, when couples have been together for a long time, they get complacent and they assume that they know everything about that person. And same thing with business people that have had the same client for years. And studies have shown that businesses will just change vendors, often without telling their current vendors what the problem is. You know, that, hey, you know, I used to need a green widget. Now, because our mechanics have changed, our insurance is different, whatever the factors are, now we need a red widget for whatever reason. Well, the same thing happens at home. you know, whether the kids have grown up or whether somebody has changed jobs or somebody has been in the same house for 20 years, that can be comforting. There can be some security in that, but there also can be some monotony in that. Having the same meal, the same time, in the same place can get old for the preparer and for the eater, regardless of sex. And so it's good to update those and check with them. See, what is new? What do you think about this? You know, I had this happen to me at work today. How would you handle that? And giving them, just like you said, that first date is critical. And you can have that first date 30 years into your marriage, because I'll guarantee that person is different than the one than how they were when you married them 30 years ago. And just showing some interest. And we all need to be validated.
Absolutely. So how, what kind of a frequency interval would you suggest if people check in with their spouses to find out if things have changed?
That would be up to the couple. I mean, they would need to renegotiate that. You know, if they haven't done it in a long time, they may need to start slowly and do it, you know, once a month. However, or they may, one of the partners may have a big void and say, I need to spend more time with you now. You know, we need more than a date. We need a weekend away. We need a week away. You know, the children are grown, the colleges are paid, the weddings are done. Let's spoil ourselves and go to that honeymoon that we never had. Or even though if we have taken vacations in the past, let's go somewhere for both of us that is just fun. Most of the business trips or most trips that people take often involve either family or business, and then they kind of wrap some time around that with their spouse. But if you just take your spouse away and just focus on one another and, just like you said, pretend that you're dating, that's how you earn it. That's how you don't take your partner for granted. And then that makes them more motivated to want to be more involved with you.
I think as relationships mature, need sets change too. So in younger couples, it may be, well, we don't share the same interests, and we're not, you know, you don't want to do anything fun and exciting like I want to do.
But right.
I think as couples mature, a lot of time the needs shift to, you know, we don't seem to agree about anything, and we can't talk about anything because it always leads to a fight. Or I talk and you don't seem to listen. And of course, that last one there, I talk and you don't listen, does seem to be a common complaint with women when it comes to men.
That is.
Have you found that to be true, too?
I have. Yeah, I've heard that concern quite a bit. And I think a lot of that stems from men being conquerors. You know, for hundreds of thousands of years, we go out, we conquer, we kill the animal, we bring it home, we give it to woman, she cook. You know, well, those days have changed dramatically, but that drive is still there in men. Men, that's why they are pretty good salespeople, because we like that challenge of a new quota. We go out and we get a client to commit to us, and then a lot of men don't service that client well, and that's why a lot of times they will get somebody else, whether it's male or female, to service an existing client, because those needs are different. Like in medical sales, which I did for 20 years, we would have to stop in at a doctor's office just to make sure that all their needs were being met, and yet there were salespeople that they went out, they were the high risk, high return. You know, if they didn't make their quota, they were fired. So they would go out and conquer. They would get that commitment from a client and then turn them over to what we called a service rep. And the service rep would follow up and maintain the relationship, get to know everybody in the office, and I understand that there are a lot of businesses using that model because the needs or the gift set for a sales rep are sometimes different from a service rep, and yet the clients need both.
So it sounds like you're suggesting that both men and women become sales reps and service reps to the account of their relationship.
Exactly. You resell that client, you resell that spouse, because once upon a time you made some, you know, if you've been together for a while, you made some promises about the things you were going to deliver to them, how their life was going to be. And that's what I understand a midlife crisis is that the difference between where people thought they were going to be and where reality turned out for them, the bigger that disparity, the more severe the midlife crisis. And men and women supposedly both go through it. There's a new term by John Gray about manopause, where men are going through something very similar. You know, hormones kind of change, but it's not as physically severe as for women. And so men have, for centuries, just been blaming it on the women. Oh, it's her. You know, she's going through the change. Well, guess what? Guys are going through that too. The testosterone doesn't put out as much as it used to. So men are going through that, and then they have the emotional adjustment, you know, where you hear they go out and get the bright red sports car and the young blonde girlfriend. You know, they have their own midlife crisis. And yet women do the opposite, where they say, okay, I've been faithful and stable for so long, and now I want some spice in my life. And studies actually show, the monogamy myth was a great study, where it showed that women are actually on an increase on the number of affairs that they're having because of a variety of factors. They've got more opportunity, whether they're out working or they sit online. They don't even have to leave their homes to find more opportunities. But women have become the men that they wanted to marry. They are now strong and powerful, and many are making good money, so they have a lot more options available. So they're not being the subservient little patronized ladies that they used to be. And that's empowering. I think that's a good thing. So men need to learn to not take them for granted.
Well, and in my opinion, you know, yes, men, I'm sure, enjoy the chase. I do, too. I like conquering various different challenges in mm-hmm. my life. But yeah. I do think that we raise men in our culture to really be afraid of their own emotions and communication. So then,
because we're not taught how to handle that.
No,
you know, men are taught to compete against one another, whereas young girls are taught to cooperate with each other.
The cultures are very different.
They are.
When I'm working with couples, a lot of times I will put the man and the woman so that they're facing each other and giving each other direct eye contact, and then I'll tell the woman, this is a challenge, an intimidation technique in male culture, to be facing somebody and looking straight into their eyes.
Mm-hmm.
And the women will be incredulous because to them, this is building intimacy and connection. Of course, we're going to look at each other face to face and stare deeply into each other's eyes.
Whereas men will confront and challenge. I remember years ago, I went to one of my wife's bunco parties and found out that was not a game of competition. They do that to sit there and roll the dice and talk amongst each other, and they cooperate, they share. And yet we guys, we got super competitive, and we thought it was beyond Yahtzee, and we were trying to beat each other. It totally changed the entire circumstance on a simple little thing like bunco.
Yeah. And of course, I mean, a lot of people would like to think that these are somehow or another innately attached to our genitals. I personally think an awful lot of it has to do with just the way we're raised. You could be in another country where you would not find that kind of competition even with males, because the culture, especially like in some Asian cultures, is very much dependent upon cooperation and working as a team.
Mm-hmm.
So,
not our capitalistic society in America.
Oh, we are.
And it is gradually changing.
We're very competitive.
We are.
Across the genders.
Right. Yeah, women are becoming more competitive. And
So getting away from some of the social commentary and mm-hmm. some of the more vague generalities, can you give our listeners some specifics on how, I'm intrigued by this concept of being both a sales and service rep to your relationship. It seems to me like if you were working in a company, there would be some very specific things, like, you know, you might be instructed to check up on the account once a month, or send a postcard, or pick up the phone and call them, or send some flyers, or maybe drop by and bring them some brochures or a gift.
Mm-hmm.
What kind of specific things could you tell couples about how they can both sell and service the account of their relationship?
Well, the number one thing is find out what's important to your spouse or your partner,
mm-hmm.
finding out what their needs are. There's a good book out now, The Five Languages of Love, where he talks about five different types of love, things that are important to some. Like some people, time is the most important thing. To some, physical touch is the most important. To some, a physical gift is the most important. And mm-hmm. if you are a person that values time, and yet your partner is constantly giving you gifts, that's not really meeting your needs.
Mm.
But gifts may be the most important thing to them. So it's not necessarily, and I'll give you an analogy in business. When I was a nurse for 9 years, and so when I went into laboratory sales, I was thinking that pricing was really important because I was used to the inpatient setting where a lot of people had had to pay out of their pocket or they had government insurance coverage. So to me, pricing was very important, and I had the flexibility to drop pricing for clients. And it took me about a year to learn that they didn't care about pricing. 95% of the patients had insurance, whether it was private or government issued, and so pricing just wasn't a big thing. They were more concerned with convenience to them in getting their laboratory results, because I sold laboratory services. And it took, like I said, it took a year, even though one of the things that made me a good medical sales rep was that because of my nursing background, I was used to asking a lot of questions, but I wasn't asking the right questions initially. So I learned the hard way, in business and at home, it's critical to find out what is the most important thing to your spouse. What are their needs that you can meet? And then you can renegotiate. Okay, well, if I do that, then how often do I need to do that? What's the frequency? It's like in business, we often had to do upsells. You know, when we had an existing client that did most of their testing with us, there was new technology that would come out. And so we would have to educate clients on a better or more rapid, less expensive ways to evaluate their patients and run tests. That's something we need to do at home as well, is update and upgrade your service to your spouse. You know, that you may not be quite as physically toned as you once were. You may not have the endurance you once did, but you can still meet other of their needs to compensate for that. You know, if their needs have changed, then find a way to meet those.
There's a discussion going on here, too, on my wall on Facebook about agape versus eros. And so I'm going to read a comment from one listener. His name is Nicholas, and he says, the example that comes to mind is from Jesus on the cross, who, when lanced in the side by a Roman soldier, makes the comment, "Forgive them, for they know not what they do." That is unconditional love. I once commented to someone who was demanding that sort of love from me that while such a variety of love exists, that isn't as a rewarding sort of love between lovers or between friends who have a mutual sense of affection and reciprocity. Whether that is earned or if it is a matter of synchronicity is what I might find debatable. Often a relationship will begin with give and take and reach a point when, for whatever reasons, that becomes impossible. And if what is left is an unconditional love on the part of anyone who remains standing, more power to him or her. I think it's possible, but it opens a whole discussion about eros versus agape and how we define love in the first place.
Mm-hmm.
What do you think about that? It kind of sounds to me like you were talking about eros and agape in the context of long-term relationships.
Yeah, and I would try to find out what was important to the partner. And that's one of the things for using a business model for love, because I know that, you know, Jesus and God can do unconditional love, but if you look for humans to do that, we're also not going to be sinless like God can be. You know, like I said, those are nice goals, but it just doesn't happen in reality, at least not in our society. So if you can find out what's important to your partner and strive to meet those needs. The beauty of using a business model is that it doesn't matter why you do what you do. The important thing is that you do it. My boss doesn't care how I meet my commissions, how I meet my quota.
Mm-hmm.
She just cares that I do meet that quota. And that's
important. I personally think it's important to have a blending of those realities. I think it's important to look at one's motives and understand why one is doing something. However, I like some of the business model that you're bringing here, just in the sense that in a lot of realities, people will say things like, "I love you, that's why I'm doing this." And the focus is so much on how they're feeling. Like, I feel this love for you, why can't you see that? And I like the fact that you're bringing in here, it doesn't really matter how you feel, does the other person gain any benefit from it? What are the end results of your behavior?
Exactly. Because that's more how men think. We don't feel as I'm more in touch with my feminine side than most men because I've worked in nursing for 9 years. I got my degree in psychology. I have worked with nothing but women in medical sales, well, almost all women, for over 20 years. So I understand that, but most guys don't care about the feelings. You know, they are actually taught to shut down feelings. When we go to war, and I was a Navy corpsman, there are situations going on there that you're not allowed to feel. It's like one of the most powerful moments of my life was after watching the movie Saving Private Ryan about D-Day. And I often stay at the end of the movies and I wait for all the credits and then I get up and leave. And when I did that this time, and I'm usually alone by that point, but after this movie, there were a good 40 to 50 men, you know, a good 10 to 20 years older than me, and most of them were crying because it brought back memories that back then men were taught big boys don't cry. Men were not allowed to have feelings. That's changing gradually, but it is contrary to our hunter style of an outlook. You know, if you have to go out and kill Bambi to feed your family, you can't be thinking, oh, that's a nice, warm, little fuzzy doe. You're thinking, that's a meal for my children. And so we were actually taught to suppress feelings, and it's just in the past couple decades actually changing, where men are given permission to start feeling. So that's one of the things I learned in psych, was that so much time is spent on analyzing why people do something, whether it's their parents' fault, whether it's nature versus nurture. In business, it's just cut and dry. Is this acceptable behavior or is it not acceptable? Is this going to meet your goals or is it not? And that's why that's more beneficial for men especially.
Well, I think it's beneficial for men to get in touch with their feelings too. And that you just shared about them, the 40 or 50 men in a theater audience crying after a movie, it's very touching. I don't think it would hurt female culture to have an injection of some cost-benefit analysis and something that's, you know, more focused on the end results, because I think results do matter. I think it's very important when we're dealing with each other to be able to talk about and also, you know, put some focus on what kind of results we're creating for each other. I especially like the fact that you encourage people to find out, does my partner appreciate the same things I do? Because if we go with the old adage, which is to do unto others as you would have them do unto you, if you stop at that, as in, well, I like chocolate, so you get chocolate.
Right, exactly.
then that's not very loving.
That's right, yeah.
And it doesn't matter how much feeling of love you had as you prepared that, what it creates for the other person can be a lot of discomfort and misery, especially if they feel like they've got to be grateful when they're not.
Right. It's like many a man got in trouble for giving his wife a vacuum cleaner or a toaster, something he's thinking is more efficient, a way to get their job and accomplish their task quicker. And yet the women, no, that's not what I want for my birthday or for Christmas, and very understandably. But it's taken men a while to, I totally agree with you, men need to be more in touch with their feelings. But we're battling thousands of years of conditioning. And
well,
I think
a blending for men and women is very nice, because
androgyny is a beautiful thing.
The female culture is very out of balance too. I've got another question here from Eric. He says, I used to believe in unconditional love, but then I was taught about boundaries. David above mentions this too. How does unconditional love for another interact with our personal boundaries? Do we love unconditionally as we walk away shaking our heads? So that makes unconditional love just an indestructible feeling of benevolence. Something out of sync there. I kind of think that's what we're talking about here. Like, you could say, I love you, I love you, I love you, but if what I'm doing to you and for you is just creating discomfort or misery for you, it's not very loving.
Oh, completely agree. The behavior is the most important thing.
Yeah.
I mean, a father who was molesting his daughter, saying, I love you, you know, that this is a special thing between you and me, is way whacked.
pretty typical standard of speech, by the way.
Yeah, I've heard that. If your words don't match your behavior, you know, whether it's good or bad, then you're in trouble.
Well, and if you're focused on what it makes me feel good to do this for you, you know, you can almost hear the defiance and the selfishness in that tone.
Yeah, you owe me because of this.
Yeah,
that's
right.
Not the case.
After all I've done for you.
Right, exactly.
Yeah. So, let's see. You have something in your book about people recovering from breakups, tools, I guess, that you provide. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Well, it's a learning opportunity. You know, it's like in business when you lose a client, it's an opportunity to look back and say, okay, what did I do wrong? What did I not do properly? And it actually gives you the chance to redefine your behavior for future relationships. And in the book, I actually provide an evaluation form, and it's to help people, and just like you would do an evaluation at work, you know, you get a yearly appraisal, you know, the things you do well, you know, whether you're punctual, you're dressed appropriately, you learn new things about the industry. And you can use that for something at home. You can evaluate your relationship before it dissolves, before it actually breaks up. But if you're going to use that tool, and I strongly suggest in the book that you need to critique yourself first, because it's not a weapon to go in and just browbeat your partner with, but it's a way to honestly, objectively evaluate both of you. You know, what you're giving is more important than what you're getting back, but they do need to be balanced. You know, you can give and give more for a while, as long as eventually you know that you're going to get your rewards as well. And if not, that's why, I mean, it's almost cliche that women have put up with abusive men or, you know, men that don't give enough, and then they just say, okay, I've had enough. I'm going to mom's, I'm moving in with a girlfriend, I'm taking the kids, goodbye. And that's fair and reasonable at work. You know, it's got to be a win-win for both. It's like on the cover of my book, the logo of it is a scale with a heart on each side, that if you give more, eventually you're probably going to get more in return. But if one partner decides that they're going to give less love, and it may take a long time to build up, but eventually the other person will probably stop giving as much love as well. The universe requires a sense of balance, and if you're just taking and taking and taking and not giving in return, you're in a real vulnerable situation.
Do you find, and I certainly have heard this a lot, or men will feel that everything was great. I thought we were getting along. I can't believe she wants to end it.
Right. What did I do wrong? You know, I give her this beautiful home. You know, she's got a new car every year. But then, like I said, that if that is his way of showing love, is to give gifts, maybe she needed time or she needed physical affection. You know, what's most important is to find out what's important to your partner. And that's why, just like you propose, is having a date. Pretend it's your first date periodically, because it is your first date with that new person, especially if you haven't had a date in a year or two or 10, that they have probably changed, and this is your opportunity to learn about them.
I see nothing more tragic than, you know, when I am out on a date, talking in animated tones with a new partner and having a hell of a good time. But you'll look across the table, and there will be an older couple that's obviously been together forever.
Yeah.
And they're just putting food in their mouth.
Not even looking or talking to each other.
Not looking or talking to each other at all.
Can't understand that.
And looking, they look so miserable. And I've seen that so many times. And it's like, why bother?
Agreed. Yeah. You must have something that you can share, even if it's just a fantasy. You know, but some people decide that they just want to shut down, that they, one of my favorite sayings in life is that confidence comes from not always being right, but from not being afraid to be wrong. And some people have taken some hard lumps, and rather than getting out and celebrating life on a daily basis, they just withdraw into a shell. And they and partners sometimes do that with them. But just like you asked a little bit ago, sometimes one partner or the other will say, I've had enough. you know, I've tried to ask you to go to counseling, you won't go, or we did go to counseling and it didn't work. You're not meeting my needs, and so I'm going to go meet my needs elsewhere. And that's the most important thing, is that you need to rely on yourself for your happiness. Don't blame your partner. Repeatedly, I've heard that in breakups, where think of yourself. When you ask somebody, well, why did you guys break up? 9.9 times out of 10, they will say, oh, they couldn't do this, or oh, they did that. It's very rarely does anybody that goes through a breakup say, well, I did this, or I didn't do that, but I'm going to do better next time.
Yeah.
Almost always the other person's fault.
Oh, always.
Always?
Pretty much.
Yep.
It's always the other guy's fault.
Right.
So true. And you were talking about getting help there. Actually, David posted something here and saying that he thinks that, in his view, that we all need a coach to help us see where we are in our perception and application of this in a relationship, ideally, and to the degree we've had experiences which tend to color our perceptions, loss, childhood abuse, trauma, abandonment, etc. We even more so need this support. Anyway, thank you, David, for your comment there. I also cued in on something else. This was a rather long posting. And he was talking about the conditional attraction, like, you know, when you meet somebody and you think, well, they've got a great body, or I like their hair color, and then how, if that's what your love is based upon, is, you know, those sort of transitory qualities, that then you can't really have a long-term successful relationship. So you touched upon that a little bit. You were talking about, okay, maybe, you know, their body might change, but there's other ways that one can meet needs.
Mm-hmm.
Just briefly, however, this whole idea of cost-benefit analysis could backfire for some superficial souls who might use it as an excuse to say, hey, when I married you, you had a tight ass, and you don't, so bye.
Right. Yeah. And she might come back with, well, you had a flat tummy, and no, you don't.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, both of us change. And so it's a matter of give and take, you know, in our expectations and what's acceptable.
But you do need to moderate some of this cost-benefit analysis with a sense of something that's perhaps a little more, spiritually centered. I mean, because you think about this, if I'm just a customer and I'm just thinking company XYZ sells pencils for 3 cents each, and then I can go over to company ABC and get pencils for 2 cents each, and they're exact same pencils, well, I'm just going to switch. That is not a successful model for long-term love relationships now.
I completely agree. Yeah, the business principles, you know, they're a format, they're a framework for men and for people to understand relationships, but that's the minimum level that we should treat somebody with. I mean, can you imagine going in and striking your boss or telling them they're a worthless piece of crap that will never amount to anything? Oftentimes we abuse those that we, quote, love the most, those that we feel secure and safe with, are the ones that get some of our worst treatment. So the business frame is not the ideal in love. That's a minimum, and you should be able to treat your spouse with even more affection and love and respect. And all those things that you do at work, we should be able to do that more, because that will motivate them. You know, if you withdraw from your client, if you withdraw from your spouse, then you're gradually becoming less valuable to them, and the idea is to become more valuable.
I think that you interject a really valuable paradigm, and I think it can intersect very nicely with some of the other things that we know about love and relationships. I see it as kind of an adjunct, a nice addition to the conversation, because I think people do really get stuck on the "I love you, so you know it must be right." And
talk is cheap. They need to do behavior.
Talk is cheap, so we need to get into action.
Yeah. And if any of your listeners are interested in ways to find romantic behaviors, at the book's website, I've actually started creating a free newsletter, which is coming out monthly, because I've had a lot of people, especially men, asking, okay, I get the principles now, I know what I'm supposed to do, but I'm just not wired like that, so can you give me some ideas? So there's a free monthly newsletter that they can sign up for at the book's website.
Can Which is address? Earn It. www.earnitbook.com.
Correct.
Yeah. I posted it to my wall, too.
Oh, great. Thank you.
All right. Thanks so much, Bob. I really appreciate you appearing in the Shame-Free Zone. Best of luck with your book.
Thank you very much. Good luck with your show.
Thank you. And for our listeners, I want to just check in with you here and let you know what's up for it. Next Monday, I am going to be interviewing Mimi Donaldson. And we're going to be continuing this trend here of talking about blending the gender approaches. Mimi Donaldson has a brand new book about football. It's called Necessary Roughness. And the subtext here is New Rules for Contact Sport of Life. And she's very much interested in helping women understand what it is men love so much about football. I know there's lots of women out there that love football, too. But I think she's speaking to women who maybe don't feel so warm about football and want to understand it so they can feel closer to their male partners. And she'll be my guest next Monday. Really appreciate you tuning in tonight, and we'll see you next Monday. Thanks. Good night.
Thank you for tuning in tonight. If you liked what you heard and you want more solutions for your love life, please call me toll-free at 888-903-0050. Once again, that number is 888-903-0050. I am the only person who answers that line, and I am usually available Monday through Friday from 10 a.m. to 10 p.m. Pacific Time. You can also visit sexwithoutshame.com to discover more of what I can do for you. And remember, your secret is safe with you. Sering kesepian.